I'm Dave Douglas. I'm a eighth generation coal miner. Had 42 years in the mining industry, 25 years as an official of the National Union of Mine Workers at branch level and at area level on the executive committee. Heavily involved in all of the big miner strikes in 69, 72, 74, 84, 85, and the last struggle that we had in 92, 93, other than the one at Whitehaven we're currently having. I've been involved in politics since I was 14. 60 years of politically conscious life, 50 of those as an anarcho-syndicalist. I've been a vegan since 1989 and a vegetarian since I was 6 years old. And would have described myself as an environmentalist and rather green up until the change of direction by some of our one-time comrades in the environmental movement.
Okay. Thanks, David. What about you, Shane? Can you introduce yourself and give us an idea about your interest in this debate on climate and energy?
Yeah, just to say, well, nice to meet you, David Douglas. That's a fine record. That's a record. Mine's nothing quite so interesting. I spent my 20s in the film business, making dodgy TV commercials, rose to the dizzy heights of directing, discovered climate change in the late 1980s, and got out of the film business, went to college, discovered Twyford Down and the anti-roads building protests, and was one of the first bunch of six people to get arrested there. Was involved with Cool Town Arts, which is a squatted community arts centre in Brixton for 4.5 years in the early 90s, mid-90s, formed up the Freedom Networks campaign against the Criminal Justice Bill, formed up Reclaim the Streets to bring a sort of urban relevance to the roads debate, because we were all had been arrested at Twyford and couldn't go there, so we thought we'd better do something in the city while our mates were getting trashed at Twyford. And sort of moved the focus away simply from road building on countrysides to, as well as climate change, use of land space in the city and air pollution. I've been a Green Party member since 89, lost 15 elections in Brixton, moved to Somerset and got elected in 2015 as a district councillor, re-elected in 2019 as district councillor, and then elected earlier on this May as a county councillor, and got abolished as a district councillor when Mendip went, got abolished in favour of unitary councils. Climate change and my worries over it made me change my life pretty dramatically in the late 80s, and has sort of governed everything I've been doing since then. Which, you know, has mostly been green stuff, quite a lot of drugs campaigning in the noughties, putting on festivals. I'm one of the directors of the Green Gathering Festival, been involved with that since 1992. It's a community interest company, and I program the speakers tend to Glastonbury Festival, and grew up a few villages away, so I've been going to Glastonbury Festival since I was a teenager. After 30 years in Brixton, moved down to Frome in Somerset for about 10 years now.
Okay, so look, we're looking at sort of two aspects of a related problem, which is climate and energy. So I'll ask you first, David, in 2 or 3 minutes, can you explain how pressing you think the climate change is? Is it, how pressing an issue is it?
I recognise there's a problem for human beings with climate change, as there always has been. I don't think there's a climate emergency. I certainly don't think there's a climate catastrophe. I think we've got particular problems with climate at the moment, partially as a contribution from human beings. It's irrefutable that human beings contribute to climate change. There's 8 billion of us on the planet. As I've said previously, if all we did was breathe and eat and shit, we'd contribute to the to climate as have all other life forms on the planet. I think I'm not particularly sold on the idea that CO2 is the main driver, but suppose it was, then I think the main thing you need to do is introduce climate carbon capture and storage, because humanity is not going to abolish fossil fuel at this stage in our development. So that being the case, if you want to rapidly reduce the amount of carbon in the atmosphere, then we have to stop it going into the atmosphere. And that doesn't mean killing the goose that laid the golden egg. It means finding ways of burning coal, oil, and gas more cleanly.
Okay, Shane. So in your view, how pressing are the dangers of climate change? I think some people feel that there is an element of alarmism here and an exaggeration.
Well, I think if you ask people in Pakistan or southern Spain or southern America or western America, they would disagree. The sort of long-term forecast, if you like, it looks like by around about 2030 we're going to hit 1.5 degrees.
I think he's been heckled by the dog.
It's unfortunate that the places that have caused the least effect on climate change are the places getting hit the hardest at the moment. But it looks like we're going to sail through 1.5 by around about 2030s. It looks like around about the mid 2030s, the Arctic summer ice cap will melt. It'll obviously come back in the summer, but the general guesstimates are around about the mid-2030s. And that is one of the major tipping points. Obviously, if the sun hits white ice, it reflects the sunshine. But if it hits dark ocean, the heat gets taken into the ocean, and there's methane hydrates on the bottom of the Arctic Sea off East Siberia, in particular the Laptev Sea, in shallow water. So if those start becoming a methane gas and bubbling up, we're in deep trouble. We could be looking at 2 degrees by the sort of mid-40s. By mid-50s, it's likely that much of the rice-growing areas of southern China, Indonesia, Thailand, Vietnam will have saline intrusion, so you won't be able to grow rice there. So rice will likely cease to be an internationally tradable commodity. By 2070, vast parts of the world around sort of the northern African latitudes, northern Indian latitudes, southern parts of the United States will become, and the Middle East, become increasingly hot, increasing numbers of days over 40 degrees. So basically plants and crops won't be able to survive.
Okay, so David, I wonder if we don't do anything about this, our grandchildren are not going to thank us, are they?
Well, I don't accept most of what's just been said. I mean, it's interesting that you choose to take Pakistan, for example, as an example, and not say Bangladesh. The contrast between Pakistan and Bangladesh is quite striking. In Bangladesh, they ignored the pressure and blackmails from the West and went on to develop their own fossil fuels. As a result, they've now got higher standard of living, longer life, longer child infantile mortality rates, and the standards of life are now coming up to the equivalent of modern developed countries. In Pakistan, you've got this huge contrast because they haven't developed the natural resources. They haven't been able to cope with the floods. Floods, droughts, fires, sandstorms, dust bowls, all of these things have happened since before we came here. And if we weren't here now, they would still be happening. We are not the cause of these things, and we've had to adapt to them. Now, we can argue all day and all night about to what degree we've contributed to climate change. But what I'm absolutely certain of is there's no way of adapting to it, or combating it, or minimizing the effects by stopping fossil fuel. That is literally cutting the other artery once you slit your wrists.
Yeah, but there's no way out of it. What Shane is implying, David, is that there's a trade-off here. We can't have both. We can't have this amazing prosperity and use fossil fuels at the same time. We've got to moderate one or the other.
I don't accept that. I don't accept that. What I believe is that we need fossil fuels in order to bias the technology and the ability to survive climate change. If human beings weren't on the planet, all of the things that have been mentioned would still be happening. We have not created these things. Net zero will not stop them. We can't change the climate to that extent. What we have to do is minimize the effects of it and to find ways of adapting to it, as we always have. Okay, you mentioned Vietnam. Vietnam has pulled itself up by its pit bootstraps in order to make a fantastic rate of development, drag themselves out of one of the most backward countries in the world, not helped by America's bloody ruthless genocidal war on them, by exploiting coal and gas and oil that they've got in Vietnam. You know, Vietnam is a success story, so is Bangladesh. And Africa, the whole continent of Africa, is being held in underdevelopment and poverty as a victim of climate because it's not developing its vast fossil fuel resources.
Shane, can you just in a nutshell explain why you think that humanity has been, I'm assuming that you do, behind the changes we're seeing in the climate?
Yes, I mean, there are obviously natural cycles, 300 or 400 year sort of cycles, and La Nina and El Nino. But I have absolutely no doubt at all that humans have caused it to get out of kilter. And, you know, that's borne out by the record of the increases in carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, basically starting in Britain with the Industrial Revolution. And, you know, 97, 99, whatever it is, percent of science agrees that the greenhouse effect is an effect, and it's been sort of fairly proven since the mid-1800s that, you know, carbon dioxide does act as a sort of greenhouse blanket.
But I mean, surely, I mean, back in the mid-1800s, I mean, were we measuring carbon levels?
Well, they can be measured from ice cores and this sort of thing. But I think the main point is that at the moment they're going up by 2 or 3 parts per million per year. And they haven't been this high for hundreds of thousands of years. And when they were this high, you know, the sea level in particular was sort of 70, 80 foot higher than it is at the moment. So okay, I Dave, really Dave, take you... issue yeah. with David yeah, saying let, that,
let, that David, you
let's
are
just go back.
Go ahead, David.
The thing about figures is, and there's an old saying, you know, that lies, damn lies, and statistics, it depends what you choose to do with them. So if you take 150 years, it's curious why you pick 150 years to do, which they call pre-industrial times, to start the measurement. Well, the reason why they pick 150 years is because it's the coldest point in 10,000 years. So if you're going to start a measure off, you start right at the bottom of the trough, at the lowest point in 10,000 years. So as Neil Kinnock might have said, the only way is up after that. So of course the temperature will rise inexorably up after that, going towards 1.5. But if you took a longer span, say you went 10,000 years and you took the measurement then, you're talking about 0.5 degrees rise, about a half a degree rise. I'm not questioning that the temperature is rising or that the CO2 level is rising. They are. To what degree it's caused by human beings is not settled at all. And this 95, 97% is a well-known lie. It's not just a false statistic, it's a lie.
Well, look, I don't think the pair of you are going to agree on this, but thank you for both putting your points of view. I'm going to move on to look at just generally at Britain and a basic principle here as to whether countries like Britain should be self-sufficient in energy. So at the moment, we're importing tremendous amounts of things like actually coal. We're also importing a lot of gas. We're importing our electricity across the channel, etc. And of course, masses and masses of oil. So I just want like to ask you maybe first, Shane, what you make of the idea that a nation like Britain should try and be and should be self-sufficient in energy and derive its energy from its own shores?
Yeah, I mean, I would take it even lower than that, that regionally we should try and be as self-sufficient as possible, but also house by house. You know, if you have a south or west facing roof on your house, ideally one would like to see every house in Britain covered with a solar panel, because it's, you know, every society depends on energy, cheap energy. And if you have a centralized energy system, you have centralized economics, because we're all paying a couple of hundred quid every month to the energy company. But if we were self-sufficient, then we wouldn't be paying out that 200 or 300 quid a month to the energy company. We'd be keeping it within the household, within the community. And that would then lead to more decentralized economics. And if you have decentralized economics, then you're much more likely to have decentralized politics. Whereas at the moment, we have centralized power production, centralized economics, and centralized politics. So that's one of the main reasons I would like to see, you know, houses as self-sufficient as possible, proper insulation. I mean, you know, we're merely talking about energy. The first thing we need to talk about is actually using less energy. And from a housing point of view, that means proper insulation. It means new builds being as close to, you know, zero emission standard, passive house standard as possible. That means cheaper bills for the people living there, less CO2 emissions, and you know, more financial independence for the person who lives there.
The trouble is that solar panel, Shane, is not going to deliver enough for most people, is it? Most people's energy use, you know, even to boil a kettle, the solar panels are going to struggle to do that.
Well, with a battery, that gives you backup. But I'm not suggesting that everybody goes completely off grid. I think being part of the grid so you can sell your energy back to the grid when you're not using it, store a bit in a battery to use it at night when you mostly do use it and it's not, the sun's not necessarily shining. But the other thing we've got to look at is wind turbines, which are getting more and more efficient. And you know, when the sun doesn't shine, often the wind does, and then there are times in particular in the winter where there is no sun and no wind.
So what you're saying, it seems to me, is that we should be self-sufficient and we shouldn't be importing. There shouldn't be this massive international trade in energy, which there has been. What do you think, David Douglas?
Well, God almighty, where do you start from? I mean, first of all, we were self-sufficient in energy. Margaret Thatcher and John Major, and by 2016, they'd closed down 200 coal mines and 160 coal power stations. In order to do that, they generated a dash for gas to build gas generating power stations. Now, gas is a finite resource in Britain, but left to just to supply the domestic market to cook your Sunday dinner on and for specialists. And for specialist industries, would have lasted hundreds of years, but it was wastelessly burnt off in power stations in order to get rid of coal. So we ended up with a situation where you'd killed coal, despite the fact we're sitting on trillions of tons of it, and you'd burnt off vast supplies of gas, making it extremely, extremely short in supply and very, very expensive, because the state thought it could import gas and oil from all over the world, and everybody would generously give it to us. And then a war which they partly generated through the international machinations of America generated the war with Ukraine, and the gas has been turned off. So now we're scrounging about and scratching about trying to find ways of generating power, because, you know, we're an industrialized economy, and you can't run an industrial economy on renewables. It's just a fact. You can't. You can have some kind of existence in the same way, you know, you can get the whole family riding a bike and generating a few light bulbs if you want. But, you know, if we're talking rationally and sanely, then you need a proper fuel economy.
But David, don't you think that the technology's moved on from coal? This is a kind of almost a Victorian technology.
Well, where's it moved on to?
Nuclear, for example?
Well, the biggest supplier of energy in the world is coal. It's overtaken oil as the biggest supplier. So coal consumption and production is rising all over the world. But, I mean, where do you imagine your wind turbines come from? You can't make a wind turbine without coal to make steel. And you can't make solar panels without graphite and coal. There are no renewable energy sources without coal. I'm sorry. Now you can manufacture all the stuff you want abroad and import it on the side, maybe at night time when nobody's looking, and pretend that we haven't created the emissions. Well, you cannot make the steel here. You can make it in Germany or Venezuela or anywhere you want. But we're going to use it. And if we use it, then we are making those emissions.
So Shane, what David's implying here is that there's been a kind of demonization of coal. Obviously, you know, there are a very powerful lobby saying we should use less of it, but surely not none at all.
David's point about needing coal to make steel, which generally has been the case. I mean, steel is now moving increasingly, well, gradually to electric. And I think that's the way that things are going. I quite understand the point about using proper anthracite for steam trains and that sort of thing. And one certainly wouldn't want to get rid of steam trains. But I think, you know, you could use some coal and still keep within our national limits that won't force climate change. But I would disagree with the main point that you can, you know, I think you can run a sort of post-industrial society on renewables.
Can I ask you, which wind turbines anywhere in the world are made from recycled steel? Because that's what the electric arc is talking about. The electric arc recycled steel. It doesn't make new steel.
But much of the blades are actually made from a sort of fiberglass, aren't they? They're not made from steel.
No, they're made from the petrochemical industry, which are not recyclable, by the way. You can't have the propellers without oil, and you can't have the actual structure without steel made from coal. You can't make high-tension, weight-bearing steel from recycled steel. You can make pots and pans and bicycles out of it. So Britain, 70% of British steel is recycled steel, which doesn't use new coal.
Can I put this to you, Shane, in this way? I mean, I think most of us can remember the battles with the miners, Ted Heath and Margaret Thatcher, at least people of our age, in the 1970s and the 1980s. And there are some people looking at this saying, well, maybe this, climate emergency is partly a kind of continuation of this assault on the mining unions that we saw from Thatcher and Ted Heath. It's actually a political thing as much as anything else.
I would disagree. I think Thatcher and Heath, it was an ideological thing so that she wasn't enthralled to the very strong unions. I think since then, the move to renewables away from fossil fuels is not ideological. It's for scientific reasons. But, you know, I do agree with that. Well, I do think the main thing that has been lost with coal is obviously the really strong communities that grew up around hundreds of people working at the same place. and the community spirit that grew up around it. And I think that is terribly missed. And one of the many terrible things Conservatives did was not bring in industry or employment to replace the mines in those villages.
Well, look, if you read George Orwell, I mean, he writes a lot about those mining communities, and he also talks about the poverty, about the slums and things like that. So, David, can you just say something about, you know, because in a way, surely it's great that this horrific job where people were dying through lack of safety, through inhaling all sorts of, you know, gases and, you know, actually things which destroy your lungs, that kind of thing, that it's actually, you know, it's a good thing that mining is over and that people are no longer exposed to those conditions.
No, instead we're exposed to chronic unemployment, high infantile mortality, low life expectancy, low educational attainment, benefit dependency, crime, drug addiction, and desperation and loss of hope. That's what we've got instead. But we'd improve the actual conditions in the mines to the point where Britain was the safest coal mining industry in the world. I didn't mean it was safe per se, but it was safer than anywhere else. Certainly safer than the miners mining uranium in Namibia and South Africa in order to fuel the power, nuclear power stations. You know, Harold Wilson thought that nuclear power grew on trees. He didn't realize you needed mining in work conditions 10 times worse than coal miners worked in to produce the uranium, you know? And the miners' union fought since nationalization was a game changer for the whole industry. And safety standards continued to rise all the way through until privatization in 92. And then, as predicted, the safety standards went out of the window and we started to get high death rates again.
Okay, but before we get on to look at nuclear, Shane, can you just say what you make of this? Because, I mean, a lot of people said, well, they're getting rid of coal basically because Britain has got actually a very safe industry, very unionised, and it's much better to just close down those pits and import that coal from abroad where the conditions for the workers and the pay for the workers is so much less.
Yeah, I think, as I said before, for Thatcher, it was ideological. She wanted to break the unions. I don't think there was any plot or conspiracy to get rid of fossil fuels and bring in renewables on her part. It was just an ideological thing.
She helped to found the IPCC.
The IPCC.
Yeah, she helped to found it in order to promote nuclear power to fulfil Nicholas Ridley's plan of 1978, which was to get rid of coal and move to nuclear because they thought they were more compliant than we were.
Yeah, well, he was a horrendous chap. Nuclear power is being touted, really, as the replacement for these fossil fuels, which have been the baseload, the big suppliers of energy on the electricity grid. What do you make of this? Because we've seen all sorts of problems, haven't we, with this new type of reactor, the EPR, I think it's called, that they're building at Hinkley C, etc. So there are some questions about whether this nuclear is going to deliver. But what about the principle of switching over to nuclear?
Well, nuclear is expensive. It takes a long, long time to build, and it obviously leaves a deadly legacy. And as David said, the mining conditions in South Africa and amongst the Navajo people in southern United States, it's truly, truly very dangerous. And we're obviously using depleted uranium in Ukraine at the moment, and that's showing up in Britain at Aldermaston on the monitoring sites. So we can fully expect to see in Ukraine and in Europe and in Britain what has been happening in Fallujah and southern Iraq, of, you know, a big increase in childhood leukemia and adult colon cancer.
Well, I think it's worth explaining a bit about depleted uranium, which is basically a byproduct of the nuclear industry. As they separate out these isotopes of uranium to use in the reactor, they get this basic like nuclear waste, effectively, which is very good. Rather than having to deal with it and pay lots of money to store it, etc., the depleted uranium is used to, you know, to make these tank shells, which apparently are very effective at killing tanks. And so there is this rather perverse byproduct of the nuclear industry, not least of which, of course, is the nuclear, the plutonium and the uranium to use to make nuclear weapons. So what do you make of the viability? Because a lot of the Greens, including the Scottish Greens, etc., Shane, are starting to say, well, actually, we need to extend the life of nuclear power stations in Scotland. And there are some of the Green campaigners who are very pro-nuclear.
Well, they're a bit late, isn't they? Hunterston's just closed down last year. The graphite blocks in that were starting to disintegrate. It's already the British nuclear power fleet has been kept going for longer than it really should have been and was designed for. The problem is that the graphite blocks within a nuclear reactor are really, really hard to get to see if they are disintegrating. The EPR reactors, the European design, which Hinkley is one and Sizewell is proposed to be another, are disastrous. I mean, there's three being built. Taishan in China has been built by EDF. They had big problems there and they've switched it off. The Chinese didn't want to switch it off, but it was insisted that they do so. Olkiluoto in Finland is about 12, 13 years behind schedule and incredibly expensive. Same with Flamanville, same with Hinkley, and it looks like the design of the sort of steel shell that surrounds the nuclear reactor, that they're having problems with brittleness of that. So,
well, look, if they can get it right, Shane, what about the principle? Are you behind the principle of nuclear energy?
No. No, I'm not, because I just think it's thoroughly irresponsible. We're leaving waste that needs to be guarded by a sort of nuclear priesthood for 150,000 years. I think it's just totally irresponsible, as well as leaving domestic consumers with extremely expensive energy. Now, the strike price for Hinkley was £98 per megawatt or gigawatt hour. And that was like 6 or 7 years ago. It's more expensive than electricity is now. So we're basically guaranteeing that future generations are going to have to pay a vast amount more than renewables for energy because the government's chosen to go with nuclear. And it's just sort of very symptomatic of centralized thinking. They just think, right, we'll build a big concrete box in Somerset that will produce 7% of the country's energy. Hey presto, next problem.
But the thing is, if nuclear isn't going to work, which is what you seem to be suggesting, and you're against it in principle, what is going to replace these the base load, the energy that the country needs? You seem to be saying that we just need to not use energy, not use electricity hardly at all, and yet we're being told we're going to have lots of energy to charge up electric cars. And, obviously things like railways are all going over to overhead electric lines. So what's going to power these things? It can't be solar and wind.
It can be, yes, on an interconnected grid. Solar, wind, tidal, interconnectors with other countries, so that if the wind is blowing somewhere or sun is blowing somewhere. You know, there have been studies done by the Centre for Alternative Technology, in particular Zero Carbon Britain. They've been doing this for years, showing how Britain can live without burning carbon. You know, it's not rocket science. It can be done. There's various studies showing it could be done, but Grant Shapps, still insists that it can't be done, and therefore we need nuclear. Therefore, we need to spend $30 billion on more carbon capture and storage.
Well, I mean, there's also the fact that there is an enormous nuclear industry out there that lobbies him pretty hard. And I'm not sure if they've got a nuclear bomb behind their back, threatening him with that as well, saying, look, if you want a nuclear bomb, you need to have this. Anyway, David, what do you make of this nuclear alternative? Because, I mean, it really, since the Second World War, it's been being touted as a clean, efficient replacement for these old fossil fuels, isn't it?
Well, I think it's ironic. In the 1980s, the National Union of Mine Workers and Friends of the Earth founded an organization called Energy 2000. And its aim was to campaign against nuclear power in support of clean coal. And Arthur Scargill was the president of the organization. And now we've got to a point where George Monbiot is the nuclear spokesman for Britain. He's a guardianista who supports nuclear power because it's anti-coal. So we've come full circle, really. I've campaigned against nuclear power all my life. My sister died of leukemia when she was 18, which was largely attributed to the nuclear bombs that were dropped in Hiroshima and Nagasaki and the Bikini Atoll and the tests and all of that at the time. Whether that was right or wrong, it brought me into the anti-nuclear movement when I was 14. And I've campaigned against them ever since. Nuclear power is not an alternative to clean coal. But, you know, the fact is you need baseload. Baseload can only be provided by gas, coal, or nuclear. And the fact is they've put all the eggs in the basket of gas at the moment. So 40% of all British energy comes from gas. And I would cancel the nuclear stations and I would stop burning gas in power stations. We need to replace that with clean coal power.
What is clean coal?
Clean coal is taking the carbon out of the process, so it doesn't go up the chimney, and sending it underground in disused oil wells and gas wells, where it can be sealed, where the previous fossil fuel was, so it doesn't enter the atmosphere. And we can do that. We've been able to do that since the 1970s, reaching a peak with Richard Budge's green energy program at Hatfield, Maine, the Don Valley program, that took 100% CO2 out of the process. It's the same hydrogenization process that Volvo is using in Sweden to try and make steel using hydrogen. The difference is we don't have hydroelectricity in the capacity that they have.
You know, can I just chip in? Because I think we've also kind of missed the idea. I mean, I go to New Zealand from time to time where they have geothermal energy there. And of course, we've also really only just started using tidal power here in the UK, David. Surely that's another alternative.
The tidal power that was attempted in Wales and in the Bay, it cost millions and millions and millions, and I think it produced 2 light bulbs worth of electricity. I mean, you can bring up all. It always reminds me of these weird Victorian inventions that started when they had the wind in their hair, and they started making, you know, gramophones on bicycles. And,
well, look, just a minute. Because we're in the Bristol Channel. I'm talking to you from Bristol, and we've got a vast, vast area of water here, probably millions of tons. Yeah. Of water.
So for twice a day,
the highest tidal range anywhere in the world, apart from Nova Scotia, coming in and out every day. Surely we can, you know, that there's a tremendous amount of potential to harness that, isn't there?
Yeah, for twice a day, you can generate electricity and at tremendous cost. But you never, ever, be serious. Tidal is never going to replace the kind of energy that we need in a country this size with this population, with still some kind of industrial base.
Okay, Shane, what do you make of the idea of geothermal and tidal then?
They've definitely got a role to play. You know, we can't put all our eggs in one basket. And I think in particular, deep geothermal, drilling down very deep into the Earth's crust and taking advantage of the heat there is another way to go. But I just want to ask, David, you mentioned Richard Budgeon's 100% carbon capture and storage in where was that?
Hatfield, Maine, my pit I worked at.
Okay.
Don Valley.
You know, my understanding of carbon capture and storage is rather like nuclear fusion. It's always 10 years away and always a few.
No. It was ready to go. The government had offered a prize. I mean, you need to read my book. All the facts are in there. I mean, that's not because I need the 10 quid. It's just all the facts are in there. It's climate change, coal, and the destruction of the coal industry. There was a prize of £1 billion offered by the government for the best carbon reduction scheme. Budge applied for the prize. The European Union gave £1 billion to the scheme and said it was the best carbon reduction scheme in the world. They raised £1 billion in private finance and the government pulled the plug on it. because they realized it would be the cheapest, cleanest energy produced in Britain, but it would lead to the rebirth of the National Union of Mine Workers, and they would rather fry their eyes alive than allow that to happen.
David, can you just explain some of the the actual practicalities of this carbon capture? How does it work?
Well, through a rather complicated process, you take the carbon out of the fuel before the energy is produced, and the carbon as a gas is then sent down the oil pipelines and the gas pipelines where it originally came out of the sea, and goes into the empty wells where it's put at pressure. It then turns into a solid when it's under pressure, and stays entombed in the places that were previously entombed the gas of the oil.
Yeah, but I understand these hydrocarbons are actually needed to burn to actually make the energy in the first place. You can't take them out before that process, can you?
Yes, it's the same process that, as I say, they're using in Sweden to make the experimental steel for Volvo.
Okay, well, look, we'll leave it for now. We'll leave this for now, but can you just give enough information if people want to follow this carbon capture system up and look it up for themselves?
You just look up the Don Valley. It was called the Don Valley Scheme, right? And it was Richard Budge's green energy. They applied for the grant. As I say, the Europeans called it the greatest carbon reduction scheme in the world. The Chinese and the Indians said they would allow that technology to be built in their countries to reduce their carbon. I mean, had it been done, it would have solved the whole problem of China's carbon emissions within about 5 years, that length of time it took you to build the plants.
Okay, actually. Well, let's Shane, do you want to just come in there?
Book. You can get my book. And you've got my email address, and you've got a picture of the book.
this is not sort of traditionally what we call carbon capture and storage, is it?
Well, some people talk about sucking the carbon out of the air. I'm not talking about that. I'm not talking about sucking general carbon out of the air, which I think incidentally is very dangerous, because how much carbon do you want to suck out of the air? We can't live without carbon.
Okay, so carbon... people can look it up in your book, or else they can look up what we've just been talking about if they want to go into that further. Yes, but okay. I'd like to just look at the principle of, I mean, for many people right now, they are against a lot of these climate measures simply because it seems to have been involved in massively pushing up the price of energy. I mean, there's been a rather crude attempt to blame this all on Russia, but I think most people can see that the energy prices have been rising for all sorts of other reasons. And we're being told, particularly with gas and electricity, that that's the actual reason for it. So, Shane, do you just want to say something about, because, you know, what would you say to someone that says, we're fed up with these Greens because the results of their lobbying is massively increasing our energy costs?
That's the line that Tufton Street takes, that the carbon, you know, that Policy Exchange takes, that all these think tanks based around Tufton Street, who are opaquely funded by dodgy American, you know, Koch brothers or fossil fuel companies. Look, renewables are cheaper to produce than coal, nuclear, certainly oil. I'm pretty sure gas. You know, nuclear, once you've built the turbine or the solar panel, your marginal costs are very, very low indeed. So, you know, renewables are far cheaper than gas. The reason gas is so expensive is after the pandemic, China and Asia, you know, had a vast economic revival. Everybody wanted gas, and the price spiked. And then with the war in Ukraine, it was the traders in the market that pushed up the price of gas. You know, the world was still producing about the same amount. But the traders use that as an excuse to say, oh, there may be trouble ahead, let's put the future price of gas up. But, you know, I absolutely repeat, renewables are cheaper than fossil fuels now.
Okay, and, David, well, I don't think you agree with that, do you?
fuels that are pushing up the price of electricity.
I absolutely refute it. It's like being in a horse race and nobbling the other horses in the race and saying your horse has won. You closed down all the coal mines, which was producing power at £35 per megawatt hour at a time when nuclear was 92 and wind offshore was £200 a megawatt hour and £150 onshore. Now you've got rid of the coal. We were supplying it for £36 from Hatfield a ton to Drax Power Station. Having closed down all the coal mines, it's now £280 a ton imported from the United States. Not that they use it for power generation very much in Britain, very little, about 1 or 2%, just to keep it ticking over. But the fact is, the reason why the coal's gone up in price is because you closed the coal mines. And the reason why wind is purported to be cheaper is because, first of all, 2/3 of all of our power bills go towards the renewables.
25%. No. Sorry, David, that is absolutely not true. You're trying to say
25% of the standard charge goes to the power bills. There's a 33% charge on all fossil fuel, which goes to the wind turbines in order to subsidize them. It's subsidized at every single level. If it had to stand on its own feet, it would be about 100. It would be dearer than nuclear.
Well, hang on, David, because surely, you know, the justification is that these new technologies need that subsidy to get going.
Well, I don't care, as long as you don't say it's cheaper. It's not cheaper. It's cheaper because it's subsidized. 2/3 of the electricity bill goes to renewables. They supply 40% of electricity. The other 40% is supplied by gas, which it shouldn't be doing. That should be clean coal.
Now, you mentioned the Drax power station. Can you say something about that? Because I've looked at some of the short documentaries and things on Drax, and I'm quite concerned, David, that it was one of the biggest coal-fired power stations in the country, and there is still a section of it. There's still a section of it which is able to burn coal when the power grid desperately needs it. But as I understand it, this is now being used to burn trees.
This was another green victory, because the Greens lobbied and stamped and spat their dummy out over wanting biofuels, which they thought was the great salvation. Biofuels was just a bloody nickname for burning trees. So now nearly all the trees that are burned in the world are burnt in Drax, and they're turned into wood pellets, put onto trains, put onto ships, transported halfway across the world. They're running trains from Immingham and from the ports through the closed mining communities into the power station to burn in the power station instead of coal, producing more CO2 than the bloody coal did.
Jane, what do you make of this? I mean, because there was a film, wasn't there? Michael Moore film, Planet of the Humans, yes, which pointed out, yes, that one of the solutions to the climate crisis was to burn these wood chips, which, I mean, ultimately means that potentially we're just burning trees, burning forests instead of coal. So is that a good idea?
No, absolutely not. But I come back to what I said earlier. The first step has to be using less energy, and that comes down in the home to proper insulation. When the Conservatives in 2012, Cameron and Osborne, cut the green crap, the amount of home insulation installations dropped by 90% within a year. You know, so that's where we need to start.
Well, you're right. And also, at that point, when the Conservatives took over the coalition government, we also saw all these solar farms popping up all over the place rather than on people's roofs. The solar generation was all going to private landowners. But look, what about Drax? Because as David said there, Drax is burning a tremendous amount of wood. And this doesn't really seem to me to be very green.
Absolutely. You know, Drax is burning clear-cut virgin forests from America, and the CO2 emissions, it just doesn't add up, as well as the obviously huge damage in clear-cutting these areas. And you know, we could quite easily, if we insulated the home houses properly, close down drags. You know, we could replace that with renewables of the range of renewables we've talked about. But, you know, I completely agree with David and, you know, modern scientific thinking that Drax is a disaster burning clear-cut forests. And, you know, as mentioned, it still does emit CO2, and you can't really argue that it's sustainable because it takes 100 years to grow the tree that you've just burnt.
No. Anyway, if people are interested, Drax is open. They take you on tours around it, so you can watch all these trees going up in smoke if you want up there. Well, look, let's just move on to talk a bit about public transport, because we're seeing a lot of closing down. I mean, for example, here in Bristol, we've now got a clean air zone where you have to pay £10 or so every day to drive in and out. We've got the extension of the ultra low emission zone in London too, out to the M25 proposed, where actually what's going on in the background is a lot of communities are saying, for example, here in Bristol, we've got an area of a council estate now which has got no bus services left since the private company pulled the bus service backwards and forwards into Bristol. We'll start with you, David. What do you make of this policy? Because they're basically saying we're going to charge people more and more for using roads and using cars, and yet the alternatives don't really seem to be there.
Well, I think that what's being revealed, and that we've always suspected, is there's a creeping eco-dictatorship where a small body of people, unelected, unappointed, without any consent from the population, is slowly being pushed to give up our living standards and the standards of life. They want to take us, they want to stop us having cars. They want us to stop using cars. They want us to stop going on holidays. They want us to stop using planes. They want us to narrowly live within the 15-mile zone where you don't come out of your shell or travel anywhere. There's a whole agenda being set behind the scenes here, which somebody, not us, have consented to. If you put the question of net zero and all of these restrictions to a referendum, I'll tell you now, we'd win two to one, we would win to scrap the whole bloody thing.
Well, because isn't it the job of a responsible government to look after the environment? Anyway, how do you respond to that, Shane? Because there are a lot of people who believe that actually what's going on here is a driving down of living standards, particularly because, obviously we've become, over the last 40 or 50 years, people have become completely almost reliant on their cars. The old system of the big railway networks of the 1950s and 60s has gone. Since the public transport has been privatised, the price has gone up, and so the alternative is to the car has sort of disappeared, hasn't it?
Look, I thought we were living under the most right-wing, extreme, near-on fascist conservative government we have ever had, and yet David talks about an eco-dictatorship. What are you on about? You know, the reason we want cars out of neighbourhoods is to improve air pollution, to allow kids to play in the streets, to allow birds back, not to be governed completely by the car.
But surely you can see that in order to get rid of the car, you've got to go back to a system of cheap, almost free public transport. I mean, public transport when I was growing up was very cheap, but it's not anymore. So there isn't any kind of alternative in place.
That's exactly what I was just about to say. You know, it has to be in tandem with vastly improved and nationalised public transport. At the moment, the bus companies are all privatised, and it's
a complete... It isn't.
Sorry, what do you mean they're not privatised?
No,
I think what David's saying is there isn't a viable alternative. What do you think's the solution to this then? Because we seem to be bringing in these restrictions on using cars before the alternatives are there, Shane.
Yes, we need free, run by the state or the council, public transport. But we have to have less cars around. You know, air pollution in urban areas in London, kids' lungs are 11% smaller because of air pollution. No, we have to get back to local neighbourhoods where we have small shops nearby, public transport nearby. People don't have to get in the car and drive a few miles to the local supermarket and park there. You know, we
But
want
whose
people
plan is
to.
that?
I'm trying to lay out a sort of green vision of a neighborhood, a locality that is not based around the car, that is based around public transport, based around having shops and schools and everything nearby, so you can either walk or bicycle there. So we start to get the cars out of our neighborhoods. Do you remember kids playing in the street, David? Do you remember bird songs in the street? That's what the 15-minute cities are
Of
about.
course I do. Of
To
course I
have
do. And
these things
I come from a community.
nearby so that we're not dependent on the car.
I come from a community where that was the norm. And I come from a
It's
childhood
not
where that
planned
was the
because of
norm. But
cars.
my issue with you is that you've drawn up a plan, and the more extreme versions of your politics in the
I've
form of
drawn up a plan, but you know, I'm just
Shane, just let him finish, please.
in the form of Extinction Rebellion and Just Stop Oil have decided on, they've been visited by God. They've got this revelation that they're going to impose these restrictions upon us, whether we like it or not. That's what I object to. That's the dictatorship I'm talking about. And on a world scale, this whole eco panic is really designed to create international world government elected by nobody, accountable to nobody, with a whole set of rules that have been drawn up without our consent or consultation. That's what
Yeah,
pains me about it.
Shane, I'll just let you answer that and then we'll get to the finish.
Yeah, that's a vast, vast misrepresentation of Extinction Rebellion and Just Stop Oil. I mean, Just Stop Oil are calling for no new oil or gas in the North
Which
Sea.
grinds everywhere to a
Just,
standstill.
hang on, David, just let him finish.
and what Extinction Rebellion have done in 3 or 4 years is that they have widened the conversation to allow us to talk about the possibilities of extinction if we carry on as business as usual.
Absolutely, I
Extinction Rebellion. Extinction
absolutely,
Rebellion.
totally, utter
Yeah,
rubbish.
well, okay,
We're
fine,
in.
but let him finish what he's saying,
David,
please, David.
okay.
Extinction Rebellion are not about pushing solutions. You know, Extinction Rebellion don't have a manifesto that says you must do this, you must do that. What Extinction Rebellion is saying, tell the truth, the government and the media should tell the truth. We should have citizens' assemblies to decide upon the way forward. And we've got to get to net zero by 2025 to have any chance of keeping below 1.5, 2 degrees. All right, Extinction
Right.
Rebellion,
So
David, are not
would you tell me,
pushing
would you tell
policies. Really, I know the people involved very well. They are not about, we
would
don't
you
have a manifesto. We're not saying you must do this. We're saying tell the truth. Citizens' assemblies, and let's get to net zero.
Okay, well, look, can I just ask you both to sum
wait a
up?
minute, wait a
Like,
minute,
hang, oh, David, go on.
wait a minute, wait a minute. If you're going to sit in the road blocking people going to an airport on the holidays, then you don't need a bloody manifesto. You're imposing your view on us. If you're going to say no oil, it means we can't do anything with the oil. And
Well,
incidentally,
I
an
think
average
Shane has
size.
pretty well explained, David. Shane has pretty well explained that he thinks that these citizens' assemblies will come up with a solution. But I'd like you, first of all, David, to give us your vision of a future. I'm thinking particularly about our transport needs and our energy needs.
Right, well, there's a lot more to be said about that. Like, you can't run a t wind turbine without oil, for example. You use 700 litres a year for an average size
But
one.
what can you
My
do?
vision
What can
would
we
be,
do, and what should we be doing?
first of all, I would scrap net zero. That has nobody's consent, nobody's agreement. We should stop all gas powered generation and build a whole new fleet of clean coal power stations, which don't emit CO2. We obviously need to open the coke and coal mine in order to make steel, in order to make wind turbines or anything else made of steel, because you can't make steel, new steel, without coal. We are to open another 30 new coal mines in order to produce the coal for a clean coal power station. I would cancel all nuclear programs. Obviously, the electrification of the railway, as long as the grid is supplied by clean coal and clean fossil fuel. I would develop shale gas in areas of low population, and transport really should be free.
Well, that's so a good point. I mean, you've just made an absolutely brilliant point there, because I remember in London in the 1980s, you probably do as well, Shane, when Ken Livingstone introduced his fair's fare policy, the actual use of cars started to plummet and people started using much more public transport. That is to say, the tubes, the trains, the buses were full of people. And in London has started thinking, well, actually, we don't need a car anymore. And of course, Bromley Council, the Tory council, put an end to that and actually overturned what had been Ken Livingstone's big manifesto pledge. So that was one way of getting rid of cars. But anyway, what's your vision for the future of energy and particularly of our ability to get around, Shane?
I just wanted to ask David, you know, you gave a long list of things. Do you see any role for renewables, David?
I've got no objection to them other than they're ugly, they're unsightly. They spoil our natural places of natural beauty, landscapes, seascapes. They kill thousands of birds all the time. But other than that, if you're obsessed by them, as long as you realise you need coal to make them.
But well, I think it's also worth saying that oil spillage has also killed quite a lot of birds. Can I just ask you, Shane, just to sum up, what is your vision? We're talking about maybe even 20, 30, 40 years in the future. What is our energy use going to look like and our ability to get around? I mean, one of the big changes we've seen in my lifetime is the pretty much ending of the reliance on the trains because it's cheaper to get around by car. That's obviously got to end. But I mean, what about our ability to get around and our energy use? Where would you like to see it going?
Yeah, well, you know, I'm in the Green Party. We want to renationalise the railways, absolutely. Renationalise energy companies. But I think if we're looking 20, 30 years ahead and we have business as usual in the meantime, you know, we are going to be looking at a vast shortage of food around the world. We're going to be looking at a fairly hellish future, and that's why young people are terrified, and so am I, and that's why, you know, young people are getting involved in Just Stop Oil, because we don't want to see new oil, and we're bloody terrified about the future. You know, it is horrendous, and I know, David, you don't seem to recognize this, but there is a lot of young people who are genuinely scared.
I don't.
About what's coming down the road, and that's
I recognise that.
But what sort of pattern of energy use do you see in the future? What would you like to see, Shane?
Well, I would like to see demand cut through proper home insulation, and I would like to see bicycle lanes wherever there are roads, electric bicycles being used far more because they are a new mode of transport. Electric cars, although we obviously can't replace 40 million cars with electric cars, but there can be some, a publicly run transport system, and flying very, very, I mean, ideally, I'd like to see we get a carbon ration. And if green people, poor people don't use their ration, they can sell it to people who want to go and see their parents in New Zealand or whatever.
So along with the kidneys.
That will redistribute wealth, David, you'd be interested in. That will redistribute wealth.
Aye, back to the rich.
And from the rich to the poor, because the poor and the greens will be selling the bit of their quota they don't use to wealthy people.
So what David's hinting at there, that there is, Shane, quite a lot of criticism of this idea of marketising carbon, you know, turning it into carbon credits and buying and selling it around the world.
Well, if it's done as a quota, it's a very different thing, because by right of being in this country, you get free a quota.
Yeah.
Okay. And each year that quota decreases by 9%, so that by 10 years' time, we're getting down to zero emissions. But in the meantime, there will be a huge redistribution of wealth, because wealthy people will want to buy the quota off people who live a greener lifestyle.
But isn't the idea energy, David, sorry, hang on a second. Isn't the idea, Shane, of using much less energy inevitably going to mean less quality of life?
No, absolutely not. That's the key thing. You know, a green lifestyle is, you don't want to listen to the greenwash we've had for the last 20, 30 years. A green lifestyle is going to be a lot simpler. Food produced closer to home, better quality food, properly insulated housing so that we spend much, much less or even nothing at all on energy in the home. You know, a passive house doesn't require any energy. It just requires good architects and good building regulations, and we don't have them at the moment.
So, David, I think what Shane's hinting at is you're part of a sort of almost like a dinosaur generation of people who got hooked on cheap energy, and that's just going to have to come to an end.
Well, I'm afraid his vision is absolutely terrifying and mortifying. Here we see that the rich continues to be rich. They have their carriages of luxury rolling down the carriageway. We walk in the pavements and watch them go by. We can sell our kidneys if we really want to make some more money. And because the health service will be privatized. It's like World War II and rationing. If you're rich, you can buy anything you want of poor people who've got nothing. And this is exactly the way that where we fall out with the Greens, we being socialists and people who support the working class. What you're trying to do is drive us back to the 20s and 30s to conditions we've just struggled to get out of. And we're not going, mate. I'm telling you that now. We are
Okay,
not going there.
Shane, do you want to just reply to that?
Yes, I think maybe David, you misunderstood me. You know, the bubble of the quota that is given out nationwide would decrease each year to eventually get down to zero. And in the meantime, it would be people who live a greener, less energy intensive lifestyle would receive income from people who want to fly to Australia to see their auntie or whatever it is. You know, it's about getting rid of the health of the wealth inequalities, not increasing them. And you must understand that, you know, this is not about something just for the rich, as you're trying to
Yeah,
portray.
but Shane, you've
See,
just described a situation where someone who's wealthy can use all these, carbon credits or whatever and actually pollute the environment because they're rich and get away with it. And also, we've got this situation with the Clean Air Zones and the ULEZ in London, where if you buy a brand new Chelsea tractor, you don't even pay it. So it does seem to be that if you're wealthy, that this isn't really going to affect you, this new carbon zero world.
I'm not sure that's the case. If you buy a Chelsea tractor, if the tire extinguishers don't let your tires down, you're still going to have to pay ULEZ charges because that's specifically what it's aimed at, big gas guzzling polluting cars.
No, but hang on, because the people who've got the up-to-date cars, very usually quite expensive ones, I mean, ones I could never afford to buy anyway, that they are compliant with the Clean Air Zone,
Well, if
and
they're
the older
electric,
cars aren't.
yes.
So in a way, this is a regressive tax, isn't it?
If they're electric, yes. But if they're a big Chelsea tractor, even if it's a new one, you know, those are what we're trying to get rid of. They're too big for the roads and they pollute too much. And that's why the tire extinguishers go around letting down their tires and leaving them a nice notice telling them why. You know, the
David,
government
can I
is
just
putting
point
out
out, David,
legislation
you're
on.
obviously critical of the XR policies and this Extinction Rebellion actions, but
Absolutely.
I mean, I think you need to explain why you are using these pejorative terms.
I don't
Well,
agree with them
you're
because they're
talking about
imposed.
an eco dictatorship.
Yes, that is an eco dictatorship. It's not the same as fascism, which is a different animal altogether. No, what we have here is a group of self-declared people who have the faith, who have this doctrine which has been visited upon them, and they're determined to impose it on the rest of the population, whether we want it or not, and we don't. That's what I'm saying. And I find the whole idea of us being grounded, trying to take us back to some sort of primitive, agricultural, isolated situation, living in our own little hamlet, it's just absolutely
Yeah,
diabolical.
but the
And
thing
if
is,
we don't.
David, it's happening. Britain is no longer an industrial nation, is it?
Well, it's still partially an industrial nation in terms of car manufacture, steelworks,
But we hardly
and
make
manufacture.
any cars anymore. Most of this stuff is made abroad, isn't it? And we import it.
That's right, but it's been exported. All of that production has been exported. I want to say, by the way, th this electric car that's such a magic fit, you realize even under normal standards, it's 40% powered by gas because it's for the grid is 40% powered by gas. And the United States electric cars are 70% coal powered or fossil fuel powered because the grid is fossil fuel powered. So the electric car doesn't mean anything. And if the battery doesn't produce the same or worse emissions in the first 5 years of a normal petrol car, I don't know. We're just going around in circles with this.
Okay, well, it's a very good point.
The bottom line for
can you
me
just
is.
let Shane answer that about the electric cars, Shane?
Yeah, I mean, they're only good if they're recharged from renewable sources. And, that can be done. And at the moment, Britain's general electricity supply is about 40% renewable. But if you have solar panels on your house and a battery, then you can charge your electric car with renewables, and it's a very good point. There's
Well,
no point
okay.
having an electric
Yeah,
car
excellent.
if
Okay,
you're
so Shane,
powering
can
it.
you just give viewers and listeners an idea of whereabouts you would point them to get further information on the green agenda for energy and transport?
Well, just type in Green Party policy, energy policy. Just Green Party energy policy, and you'll get straight to the manifesto. But basically, it's less cars, more bicycles, more walking, more local shops, more food production, so you don't need to rely on a car so much. And we just got to get cars off the streets more and return them to people and bicycles.
Okay, and
And
David, could you just let us know a bit about something? I mean, I know you've written several books, but particularly your latest one on climate. Can you just explain a bit about that and how people can get hold of it if they
well,
want?
well, you can get it at one or two places, like the library at South Shields and
So,
one or two other
what's the
places.
title of the book to start
The
with?
title is Coal, Climate Change and the Total Destruction of the British Mining Industry. And it looks at all of the things we've been talking about here and the trajectory of how we've got from where we are to where we are now and why. And what we're heading to. I mean, that the plan as just outlined by my friend there is absolutely disastrous to me. And if you ever put that in an election to people, you wouldn't get a vote. It's and people, you're right, young people are terrified. They're scared shitless because you've scared them. You've told them the world's going to end in 9 years' time.
Okay,
You
look,
know, they don't
hang on,
understand.
David. Can you just explain how people can get hold of your book first?
Oh, I'm sorry. You can get it from Lowcase Douglas, DouglasS, David, 705 at gmail.com. That's Douglas David 705 at gmail.com. It'll cost you £10 plus £5 postage. Just send me your name and address and a check or transfer or whatever, and I shall send you the book post haste.
Okay, have you any final
Just
comments, Shane?
yes, I mean, Extinction Rebellion or Just Stop Oil or Greens or whoever, David, we're not saying the world is going to end in 9 years and terrifying young people. But, you've got to understand there's about 12 or 15 climate tipping points around the world that if we tip over on them, there is no way back. We're looking at 1.5, 2, 3 degrees, 4 degrees, and a world that many parts of which will be unarable, and so that will lead to millions of people having to move. And we have to tell the truth. We have to tell, people have to realize that that is a very real possibility under business as usual. But that gives us the impetus to make huge changes, and that's why Just Stop Oil. Geez, in a year and a half, they just managed to get the Labour Party to agree to no new oil or gas in the North Sea. It's amazingly successful. But I just reiterate, it's just stopping new oil. We're not saying everybody has to stop using gas and oil immediately. It's new oil.
Okay,
Right.
David,
And
in your closing remarks too, please.
well, it's just so ridiculous, isn't it? If you're using 700 litres of oil to make your wind turbines work and you want to build far more wind turbines, you're going to be using far more oil. Doesn't matter whether it's new oil or old oil, you need oil there's not enough oil coming out of the North Sea. We need to expand the North Sea oil production, gas production, coal production, and the world needs more energy. It needs more energy in order to drag people out of poverty and take us into the 21st century. And the way we overcome any adverse environmental conditions is by able to have technology and modern means of adapting to
well,
it.
Well, look, let's hope our politicians and policymakers actually make some sense of all of this. I would just point out that Shane did say he doesn't believe that we should completely stop oil. We should be stopping new oil. So both Shane what Collins and David Douglas, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. And nice to meet you, David. And I shall look at those references.
Right. At least we agree on biofuel and nuclear.
Yes. All right. Thank you.